hours. Kathy collected requests and relayed them to Zaytoun. Zaytoun discovered that one of his carpenters, James Crosso, was still in the city, so the two of them spent the day driving around, rigging the houses on the list. James's wife worked for one of the hotels downtown, and the couple was planning to ride the storm out there. Zaytoun and James drove from job to job, a quarter ton of plywood in the back of the truck, doing what they could before the winds came. The roads were still crowded, a new surge of cars leaving, but Zaytoun didn't consider it. He'd be safe in their house on Dart Street, he figured, far from any levees, with two stories, plenty of tools, and food. Mid-morning, Mayor Nagin ordered the city's first-ever mandatory evacuation. Anyone who could leave must leave. All day, Zaytoun and James saw people lined up at bus stops, those who planned to stay in the Superdome. Families, couples, elderly men and women carrying their belongings in backpacks, suitcases, garbage bags. Seeing them exposed like that, as the winds picked up and the sky darkened, worried Zaytoun. He and James passed the same groups, waiting patiently, on the way to their job sites and on their way back. In Baton Rouge, the weather was dark and unruly. High winds, black skies at noon. The kids played outside for a while, but then came inside to watch DVDs, while Kathy caught up with Patty and Marianne. The trees in the neighborhood swung wildly. The power went out at 5 o'clock. The kids played board games by candlelight. Kathy periodically went out to the car to listen to the news on the radio. The winds were smashing windows in New Orleans, knocking down trees and power lines. Kathy tried to call Zaytoun, but the call went straight to his voicemail. She tried the home phone. Nothing. The lines were down, she assumed. The hurricane hadn't hit the city yet, and already she had no way to reach her husband. By 6 o'clock, Zaytoun had dropped James off and was home and ready. He watched the news on TV. The reports hadn't changed much. The outermost edge of the hurricane was expected about midnight. He assumed that would be the end of the electrical grid for a few days. Walking through the darkening rooms, Zaytoun assessed all the possible dangers he'd face during the storm. The house had 4 bedrooms, the master bedroom on the first floor, and the kids' rooms upstairs. He expected leaks up there. Portions of the roof might be compromised. A few windows might break. The front sitting room, with its bay window, was at risk. There was an outside chance the tree in the backyard would fall on the house. If that happened, there could be significant damage, because nothing then could keep the water out. But he was optimistic, and in any case he wanted to be in the house, on which he'd spent untold thousands for improvements, to protect it in whatever way possible. His grandmother had stayed put during countless storms in her home on Arwad Island, and he planned to do the same. A home was worth fighting for. The only thing that concerned him was the levees. Again and again, the news reports warned of the storm surge. The levees were meant to hold back 14 feet of water, and the storm surges in the Gulf were already 19-20 feet high. If the levees were breached, he knew the battle would be lost. He called Kathy at 8 o'clock. "There you are," she said. "You disappeared." He looked at his phone and saw that he'd missed 3 calls from her. "Coverage must be spotty already," he said. His phone hadn't rung. He told her that nothing significant had happened yet, just strong winds, nothing new. "Stay away from the windows," she said. He said he would try. Kathy wondered aloud if there was something foolish in what they were doing. Her husband was in the path of a Category 5 hurricane, and they were talking about staying away from the windows. "Say goodnight to the kids," he said. She said she would. "Better go, to save the battery," he said. They said goodnight. The kids asleep, Kathy sat on the couch in her brother Andy's house and stared at the candle in front of her. It was the only light left on in the house. Just after 11 o'clock, the front end of the storm arrived at Zaytoun's house. The sky was a brutal gray, the winds swirling and cool. Rain came in sheets. Every half hour brought an escalation in the mayhem outside. At midnight, the power went out. The leaks began at about 2 or 3. The first was in the corner of Nadima's bedroom. Zaytoun went down to the garage and retrieved a 40-gallon garbage can to catch the water. Another leak opened a few minutes later, this one in the upstairs hallway. Zaytoun found another garbage can. A window in the master bedroom broke just after 3 o'clock, as if a brick had been thrown through the glass. Zaytoun gathered the shards and stuffed the opening with a pillow. Another leak opened in Sophia and Aisha's room. He found another, bigger garbage can. He dragged the first two garbage cans outside and dumped them on the lawn. The sky was a child's finger painting, blue and black hastily mixed. The wind was cooler. The neighborhood was utterly dark. As he stood on the lawn, he heard a tree fall somewhere on the block. A crack and then a shush as the branches pushed down through other trees and rested against the side of a house. He went inside. Another window had broken. He stuffed another pillow into it. Branches clawed at the walls, the roof. There were unknown thumps everywhere. The bones of the house seemed to be moaning under the strain of it all. The house was under assault. When he next checked, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. He hadn't stopped moving in 5 hours. If the damage continued at this pace, it would be worse than he had predicted. And the real storm hadn't come yet. In the small hours, Zaytoun had a thought. He didn't expect the city to flood, but he knew a flood wasn't impossible. So he walked outside, tasting the cool wind, and dragged his second-hand canoe from the garage and righted it. He wanted to have it ready. If Kathy could only see him now, she'd rolled her eyes when she saw him come home with that canoe. He'd bought it a few years before, from a client in Bayou St. John. When the client was moving, Zaytoun had seen it on his lawn, a standard aluminum model, and asked him if he was selling it. The client laughed. "You want that?" he asked. Zaytoun bought it on the spot for $75. Something about the canoe had intrigued him. It was well-made, undamaged, with a pair of wooden benches inside. It was about 16 feet long, built for 2 people. It seemed to speak of exploration, of escape. He tied it to the top of his van and brought it home. Through the living room window, Kathy saw him pull up. She met him at the door. "No way," she said. "What?" Zaytoun said, smiling. "You're crazy," she said. Kathy liked to act exasperated, but Zaytoun's romantic side was central to why she loved him. She knew that any kind of boat reminded him of his childhood. How could she deny him a used canoe? She was fairly certain he would never use it, but having it in the garage, she knew, would mean something to him. A connection to the past, the possibility of adventure. Whatever it was, she wouldn't stand in the way. He did try, 2 or 3 times, to get his daughters interested in the canoe. He brought them to Bayou St. John, put the canoe in the water, and sat down inside. When he reached for Nadima, standing on the grass, she refused. The younger girls weren't having it either. So for half an hour, as the girls watched from the grass, he paddled around by himself, trying to make it all look fun, irresistible. When he returned, they still wanted no part of it. So he put the canoe back on the roof of the van, and they all went home. The wind picked up after 5 o'clock. He couldn't tell when the hurricane actually made landfall, but the day barely brightened that morning. It went from black to a charcoal gray, the rain like pebbles thrown against glass. He could hear tree limbs succumbing to the wind, great exhalations as their trunks fell on streets and roofs. Eventually, he couldn't stay awake. Though his house was under attack, he lay down, knowing something would awaken him soon enough, and so, surrendering for now, he fell into a shallow sleep. Monday, August 29th. Zaytun woke late. He couldn't believe his watch. It was after 10 a.m. He hadn't slept that late in years. All the clocks had stopped. He got up, tried the light switches in three rooms. The power was still out. The wind was strong outside, the sky still dark. The rain was coming down, not heavily, but enough to keep Zaytun inside much of the day. He ate breakfast and checked for any other damage to the house. He put buckets under two new leaks. Overall, the damage had remained at about the level it had been at before he fell asleep. He'd slumbered through the worst of the hurricane. Through the windows, he could see the streets were covered with downed power lines and fallen trees and about a foot of water. It was bad, but not much worse than a handful of storms he could remember. In Baton Rouge, Kathy brought her kids to Walmart to stock up on supplies and buy flashlights. Inside, there seemed to be more people than products. She'd never seen anything like it. The place had been bought out, the shelves nearly bare. It looked like the end of the world. The kids were scared, holding on to her. Kathy looked for ice and was told that the ice was long gone. Improbably, she found a package of two flashlights, the last one, and reached for it a split second before another woman did. She gave the woman an apologetic smile and went to the checkout counter. In the afternoon, the wind and rain calmed. Zaytun went outside to explore. It was warm, over 80 degrees. He estimated there were 18 inches of water on the ground. It was rainwater, murky and gray-brown, but soon he knew it would drain away. He looked in the backyard. There was the canoe. It called to him, floating and ready. It was a rare opportunity, he thought, to be able to glide over the roads. He had only this day. He bailed the water, resting in the hull, and in his t-shirt and shorts and sneakers, he stepped in. Leaving the yard was difficult. A tree across the street had been ripped from its roots and lay across the road, branches spread over his driveway. He paddled around them and looked back to the house. No great damage to the exterior. Some shingles missing from the roof. The windows broken. A gutter that would need remounting. Nothing too bad. 3 days' work. In the neighborhood, other homes had been hit by all manner of debris. Windows had been blown out. Wet black branches covered cars, the street. Everywhere, trees had been pulled out of the earth and lay flat. The quiet was profound. The wind rippled the water, but otherwise all was silent. No cars moved, no planes flew. A few neighbors stood on their porches or waded through their yards assessing damage. No one knew where to start or when. He knew he'd be giving many estimates in the coming weeks. He paddled only a few blocks before he began to have second thoughts. There were power lines down everywhere. What would exposed lines do if they made contact with his aluminum canoe? Besides, there wasn't enough water to paddle much. In some parts of the neighborhood, there was scarcely any water at all, only a few inches. He ran aground, got out, turned the canoe around, and paddled back home. Throughout the afternoon, the water fled from the streets, a few inches an hour. The drainage system was working. By that evening, the water had receded completely. The streets were dry. The damage was extensive, but really no worse than a handful of other storms he could remember. And it was over. He called Kathy. Come back, he said. Kathy was tempted, but it was already 7 o'clock. They were about to eat dinner, and she knew she wasn't about to drive through the night again with 4 kids and a flatulent dog. Besides, there was no power in New Orleans, so they'd be returning to the same situation they were suffering through in Baton Rouge. The kids were still enjoying the time spent with their cousins. The laughter rattling the house was testament to it. She and Zaytoun agreed to talk about it again in the morning, though they both expected Kathy to be packing up the kids sometime the next day. She went inside, and the combined families, 3 adults and 8 kids, ate hot dogs by candlelight. That her sisters had put pork on the table didn't go unnoticed, but Kathy vowed not to make an issue of it. Better to let it go, she said to herself. Let it go, let it go. She had so many battles to fight. There would be so many more in the coming days, she was sure, that she couldn't expend her energy on her sisters, on hot dogs. If they wanted to serve her children pork, they could try. Later, when Kathy went to the car to steal a few moments with the radio, she heard Mayor Nagin echoing her reluctance to return. Don't come back yet, he said. Wait to see what the damage is until everything is settled and cleaned up. Give it a day or two. In the afternoon, Zaytoun got a call from Adnan, a second cousin on Zaytoun's mother's side. Adnan had done well since emigrating over a decade earlier. He owned and managed 4 subway franchises in New Orleans. His wife, Abir, was 6 months pregnant with their first child. You still in the city? He asked, assuming Zaytoun was. Of course I am. You in Baton Rouge? Zaytoun asked. I am. Adnan had driven up the night before with Abir and his elderly parents. How is it there? Windy, Zaytoun said. Really, it's a little scary. He would never have admitted this to Kathy, but he could confide in Adnan. You think you'll stay? Adnan asked. Zaytoun said he planned to, and offered to look after Adnan's shops. Before Adnan had left the city, he'd emptied the cash register at the City Park Avenue location and made sure bread was baked. He'd assumed he'd be back on Tuesday. You know any mosques in Baton Rouge? Adnan asked. All the motels were booked, and he and Abir knew no one in Baton Rouge. They'd been able to place Adnan's parents in a mosque the previous night, but there were already hundreds of people there, sleeping on the floors, and they couldn't accommodate more. Adnan and Abir had spent the night in their car. I don't, Zaytoun said, but call Kathy. She's with family. They'll take you in, I'm sure. He gave Adnan her cell phone number. Zaytoun emptied all the buckets in the house, put them under the holes in the roof again, and got ready for bed. It was warm outside, stifling inside. He lay in the dark. He thought about the strength of the storm, its duration, how oddly minimal the damage had been to this house. He went to the front window. Already at 8 o'clock, the streets were dry as bone. All that effort to flee, and for what? Hundreds of thousands of people rushing north for this. A few inches of water, all of it now gone. It was quiet that night. He heard no wind, no voices, no sirens. There was only the sound of a city breathing as he breathed, weary from the fight, grateful it was over. Tuesday, August 30th. Zaytoun woke up late again. He squinted at the window above, saw the same gray sky, heard the same strange quiet. He'd never known a time like this. He couldn't drive anywhere, couldn't work. For the first time in decades, there was nothing to do. It would be a day of calm, of rest. He felt strangely lethargic, ethereally content. He fell back into a shallow sleep. Arwad Island, his family's ancestral home, was soaked in light. The sun was constant there, a warm white light that bleached the stone buildings and cobblestone alleys, that brought incredible clarity to the surrounding cobalt sea. When Zaytun dreamt of Arwad, it was the Arwad he visited during the summers of his boyhood. And in these dreams, he was doing boyish things, sprinting around the island's tiny perimeter, scaring seagulls to flight, searching in the tide pools for crabs and shells or whatever oddities had been thrown onto the island's rocky shore. By the outer wall, facing the western expanse of the sea, he and Ahmed chased a lone chicken through the ruins around the outermost homes. The scrawny bird raced up a pile of garbage and rubble and into a cave of coral and masonry. They turned at the sound of a frigate dropping anchor, waiting to land at Tartus, the port city a mile east. There were always a half dozen ships, tankers and freighters, waiting for a berth at the busy port, and often they would anchor close enough to cast a shadow over the tiny island. Abdulrahman and Ahmed would stare up at them, the hulls rising 20, 30 feet over the sea. The boys would wave to the crew and dream of being aboard. It seemed a life of impossible romance and freedom. Even then, when Ahmed was a skinny, tanned boy of 15, he knew he'd be a sailor. He was careful not to tell his father, but he was certain he wanted to steer one of those ships. He wanted to guide great vessels around the world, to speak a dozen languages, to know the people of every nation. Abdulrahman never doubted that Ahmed would do this. Ahmed was, in Abdulrahman's eyes, capable of anything. He was his best friend, his hero, and teacher. Ahmed taught him how to spear a fish, how to row a boat alone, how to dive from the great Phoenician stones on the island's southern wall. He would have followed Ahmed anywhere, and often did. The boys stripped to their underwear and set out for a narrow archipelago of rocks. Abdulrahman and Ahmed found the spear they kept hidden in the stones and took turns diving for fish. Swimming came naturally to the boys of the Zaytun family and to all the children of Arwad. They could swim as soon as they could walk and would stay in the water, swimming and treading for hours. When Ahmed and Abdulrahman emerged, they'd lay on a low stone wall, the sea on one side and the town's outer promenade on the other. The promenade wasn't much to look at, a wide, crumbling paved area dotted with litter, evidence of the island's half-hearted attempts to attract tourists. Most of the residents of Arwad didn't much care if visitors came or not. It was home, and a place where real industry happened. Fish were caught, cleaned, and brought to the mainland, and ships, strong wooden sailboats of one or two or three masts, were built using methods perfected on the island centuries before. Arwad had been a strategic military possession for an endless succession of sea powers. The Phoenicians, the Assyrians, the Achaemenid Persians, the Greeks under Alexander, the Romans, the Crusaders, the Mongols, the Turks, the French, and the British. Various walls and battlements, in pieces and all but gone, spoke of past fortresses. Two small castles, scarcely altered since the Middle Ages, stood in the center of the island and could be explored by curious children. Abdulrahman and Ahmed often ran up the smooth stone stairs of the lookout tower by their home, pretending they were spotting invaders, sounding bells of warning, planning their defenses. But usually their games took place in the water. They were never more than a few steps from the cool Mediterranean, and Abdulrahman would follow Ahmed to the shore and up the great Phoenician stones of the wall. From the top, they could see into the windows of the higher-sitting dwellings of the town. Then they'd turn to the sea and dive. After swimming, they'd lay on the stone wall, the surface polished by the crashing waves and the feet of uncountable children. They warmed themselves with the heat of the rocks and the sun above. They would talk of heroes who'd defended the island, of armies and saints who'd stopped there, and they'd talk of their plans, their own great deeds and explorations. Soon, the two of them would grow quiet, near sleep, hearing the waves push against the island's outer walls, the ceaseless shushing of the sea. But in Zaytoun's half-dream, the sound of the ocean seemed wrong. It was both quieter and less rhythmic, not an ebb and flow, but instead the constant whisper of a river. The dissonance woke him. Part 2. Tuesday, August 30th. Zaytoun opened his eyes again. He was home, in his daughter Nadima's room, under her covers, looking through the window at a dirty white sky. The sound continued, something like running water. But there was no rain, no leaks. He thought a pipe might have broken, but that couldn't be it. The sound wasn't right. This was more like a river, the movement of great volumes of water. He sat up and looked down through the window that faced the backyard. He saw water, a wide sea of it. It was coming from the north. It flowed into the yard, under the house, rising quickly. He couldn't make sense of it. The day before, the water had receded, as he had expected it to. But now, it had returned, far stronger. And this water was different from the murky rainwater of the day before. This water was green and clear. This was lake water. At that moment, Zaytoun knew that the levees had been overtopped or compromised. There could be no doubt. The city would soon be underwater. If the water was here, he knew, it was already covering most of New Orleans. He knew it would keep coming, would likely rise 8 feet or more in his neighborhood, and more elsewhere. He knew the recovery would take months or years. He knew the flood had come. He called Kathy. "The water's coming," he said.
"What?"
"No, no," she said. "Levees broke?"
"I think so."
"I can't believe it." He heard her stifle a sob.
"I better go," he said.
He hung up and went to work. Elevate, he thought. Elevate, elevate. Everything had to be brought to the second floor. He recalled the worst of the predictions before the storm. If the levees broke, there would be 10-15 feet of water in some places. Methodically, he began to prepare. Everything of value had to be brought higher. The work was simply work, and he went about it calmly and quickly. He took the TV, the DVD player, the stereo, all the electronics upstairs. He gathered all the kids' games and books and encyclopedias and carried those up next. Things were tense at the house in Baton Rouge. With the weather windy and gray and so many people sharing a small house, tempers were flaring. Kathy thought it best to make her family scarce. She and her kids put away their sleeping bags and pillows and left in the Odyssey, intending to drive around most of the day, going to malls or restaurants, anything to kill time. They'd return late, after dinner, only to sleep. She prayed that they could return to New Orleans the next day. Kathy called Zaytoun from the road.
"My jewelry box," she said.
He found that, and the good china, and he brought it all upstairs. He emptied the refrigerator. He left the freezer full. He put all the chairs on top of the dining room table. Unable to carry a heavy chest, he put it on a mattress and dragged it up the stairs. He placed one couch on top of another, sacrificing one to save the other. Then he got more books. He saved all the books. Kathy called again. I told you not to cancel the property insurance, she said.
She was right. Just 3 weeks before, he'd chosen not to renew the part of their flood insurance that covered their furniture, everything in the house. He hadn't wanted to spend the money. He admitted she was right, and knew she would remind him of it for years to come. "Can we talk about it later?" he asked.
Zaytoun went outside, the air humid and gusty. He tied the canoe to the back porch. The water was whispering through the cracks in the back fence, rising up. It was flowing into his yard at an astonishing rate. As he stood, it swallowed his ankles and crawled up his shins. Back inside, he continued to move everything of value upward. As he did, he watched the water erase the floor and climb the walls. In an hour, there was 3 feet of water indoors, and his house was 3 feet above street level. But the water was clean. It was translucent, almost green in tint. He watched it fill his dining room, momentarily struck by the beauty of the sight. It brought forth a vague memory of a storm on Arwad Island when he was just a boy, when the Mediterranean rose up and swallowed the lower-sitting homes, the blue-green sea sitting inside living rooms and bedrooms and kitchens. The water breached and dodged the Phoenician stones surrounding the island without any difficulty at all. At that moment, Zaytoun had an idea. He knew the fish in his tank wouldn't survive without filtration or food, so he reached inside and liberated them. He dropped them in the water that filled the house. It was the best chance they had. They swam down and away. Using his cell phone, he talked to Kathy throughout the day. They reviewed what couldn't be saved, the furniture too large to carry upstairs. There were dressers, armoires. He removed all the drawers he could, carried upstairs everything that could be removed and lifted. The water devoured the cabinets and windows. Zaytoun watched, dismayed, as it rose 4, 5, 6 feet in the house, above the electrical box, the phone box. He would have no access to electricity or a landline for weeks. By nightfall, the neighborhood was under 9 feet of water, and Zaytoun could no longer go downstairs. He was spent. He'd done all he could. He lay on Nadima's bed on the second floor and called Kathy. She was driving around with the kids, dreading a return to the house in Baton Rouge. "I saved all I could," he said. "I'm glad you were there," she said, and meant it. If he hadn't been at home, they would have lost everything. They talked about what would become of the house, of the city. They knew the house would have to be gutted, all the insulation and wiring replaced, the plaster and sheetrock and paint and wallpaper, everything down to the studs was gone. And if there was this much water uptown, there was more in other neighborhoods. He thought of them, the houses near the lake and the houses near the levees. They didn't stand a chance. As they talked, Zaytoun realized his phone was dying. Without electricity, they both knew when his battery was gone, there would be no reliable way to call out. "Better go," he said.
"Please leave," she said, "tomorrow."
"No, no," he said. But even as he spoke, he was reconsidering. He hadn't anticipated being confined to this house for long. He knew there was enough food for a week or more, but now the situation would present a greater strain than he'd planned. "Tell the kids I said goodnight," he said. She said she would. He turned off his phone to conserve what power it had left. Kathy was still driving. She'd exhausted all means of diversion and was about to go back to her brother's house when her phone rang again. It was Adnan. He was in Baton Rouge with his wife Abir, he said, and they had no place to stay. "Where'd you stay last night?" Kathy asked. "In the car," he
he said, sounding apologetic and ashamed.
Oh, my God, she said. Let me see what I can do.
She planned to ask Marianne and Patty once she got back to the house. It would be crowded, but there was no way a pregnant woman should be sleeping in a car when there was enough room at her family's house. When Kathy returned to Andy's, it was 10 o'clock, and the rooms were dark. All the kids, save Nadima, were asleep in the car. She roused them and walked quietly into the house. After the kids were settled in their sleeping bags, Marianne appeared and confronted her.
"Where were you all day?"
"Out," Kathy said, "trying to stay out of the way."
"Do you know how expensive gas is?" Marianne said.
"Excuse me," Kathy said. "I didn't know you were paying for my gas." Kathy was exasperated, defeated. In the house, they were made to feel burdensome. Now she was being scolded for leaving. She vowed to herself to get through the night and think of a new plan the next day. Maybe she could drive to Phoenix to stay with Yuko. It was a ludicrous idea to travel 1,500 miles when her blood relatives lived 50 miles from New Orleans, but she'd run to Yuko's house before and could do so again. The tension was bad enough already, but for Adnan and Abir's sake, Kathy had to ask. After all, Marianne knew them. She'd met Adnan and Abir many times. Couldn't they stay for one night?
"Absolutely not," Marianne said.
On the dark second floor, Zaytoun held a flashlight between his teeth, sifting through the pile of belongings he'd salvaged. He shelved the books he could. He boxed the certificates and pictures. He found pictures of his children when they were smaller, pictures from a vacation they'd all taken to Spain, pictures from their trip to Syria. He organized them, found a plastic bag, put them safely inside, and then reboxed them. In another, older box, he came upon another photo, sepia-toned and in a rickety frame, and paused. He hadn't seen it in years. He and his brother Louis and sister Zakia were playing with their brother, Muhammad, 18 years older. They were all wrestling with him in the bedroom Zaytoun and Ahmed and all the younger boys had shared in Jable. There little Abdul Rahman was, on the far right, maybe 5 years old, his tiny fingers swallowed by Muhammad's huge hand. Zaytoun stared at his brother's electric smile. Muhammad had everything then. He was everything, the most famous and accomplished athlete in Syrian history. He was a long-distance ocean swimmer, one of the best the world had ever known. That he was from a country not well known for its coast made his achievements all the more remarkable. He had won races in Syria, Lebanon, and Italy. He could swim 30 miles at a stretch, and faster than anyone else. Faster than any Italian, any Englishman or Frenchman or Greek. Zaytoun examined the picture more closely. Poor Muhammad, he thought. All his brothers and sisters swamping him. They did that to him whenever he was home. The races, in Greece, Italy, the United States, kept him away too long. He was feted by heads of state and featured in newspapers and magazines all over the world. They called him the human torpedo, the Nile alligator, the miracle. When he was home, his siblings went wild, buzzing around him like flies. And then, at age 24, he was gone. Killed in a car accident in Egypt, just before a race in the Suez Canal. Zaytoun still missed him terribly, though he was only 6 when it happened. After that, he knew Muhammad only through stories, photos, and tributes, and the monument to him that stood on the waterfront in Jable, just down the street from their home. Growing up, they had to pass it every day, and its presence made forgetting Muhammad even momentarily, impossible. Zaytoun sat and stared at the photo for a minute or so before putting it back in the box. He couldn't sleep inside the house. It was hotter this night, and in New Orleans, he'd never withstood this kind of heat without air conditioning. Laying on sweat-soaked sheets, he had a thought. He looked in one of the upstairs closets for the tent he'd bought a few years back. The previous summer, he'd set it up in the backyard, and the kids had slept outside when the heat relented and allowed it. He found the tent and crawled through the window of Nadima's room and onto the roof. Outside, it was cooler, a breeze cutting through the stagnant air. The roof over the garage was flat, and he'd set up the tent there, securing it with books and a few cinder blocks. He dragged one of the kids' mattresses out and squeezed it through the tent's door. The difference was vast. Laying on the mattress, he listened for the movement of water. Was it still rising? He wouldn't be surprised. He wouldn't be shocked if, come morning, there was 12-13 feet of water covering the neighborhood. The darkness around him was complete, the night silent but for the dogs. First a few, then dozens. From all corners of the neighborhood he heard them howling. The neighborhood was full of dogs, so he was accustomed to their barking. On any given night, one would become excited by something and set off the rest, an arrhythmic call and response that could last hours until they calmed, one by one, into silence. But this night was different. These dogs had been left behind, and now they knew it. There was a bewilderment, an anger in their cries that cut the night into shards. Wednesday, August 31st. Zaytoun woke with the sun and crawled out of his tent. The day was bright, and as far as he could see in any direction, the city was underwater. Though every resident of New Orleans imagines great floods, knows that such a thing is possible in a city surrounded by water and ill-conceived levees, the sight, in the light of day, was beyond anything he had imagined. He could only think of Judgment Day, of Noah and 40 days of rain. And yet, it was so quiet, so still. Nothing moved. He sat on the roof and scanned the horizon, looking for any person, any animal or machine moving. Nothing. As he did his morning prayers, a helicopter broke the silence, shooting across the treetops and heading downtown. Zaytoun looked down from the roof to find the water at the same level as the night before. He felt some relief in knowing that it would likely remain there, or even drop a foot once it reached an equilibrium with Lake Pontchartrain. Zaytoun sat beside his tent, eating cereal he'd salvaged from the kitchen. Even with the water no longer rising, he knew he could do nothing at home. He'd saved what he could save, and there was nothing else to do here until the water receded. When he'd eaten, he felt restless, trapped. The water was too deep to wade into, its contents too suspect to swim through. But there was the canoe. He saw it, floating above the yard, tethered to the house. Amid the devastation of the city, standing on the roof of his drowned home, Zaytoun felt something like inspiration. He imagined floating alone through the streets of his city. In a way, this was a new world, uncharted. He could be an explorer. He could see things first. He climbed down the side of the house and lowered himself into the canoe. He untied the rope and set out. He paddled down Dart Street, the water flat and clear. And strangely, almost immediately, Zaytoun felt at peace. The damage to the neighborhood was extraordinary, but there was an odd calm in his heart. So much had been lost, but but there was a stillness to the city that was almost hypnotic. He coasted away from his home, passing over bicycles and cars, their antennae scraping the bottom of his canoe. Every vehicle, old and new, was gone, unsalvageable. The numbers filled his head. There were 100,000 cars lost in the flood, maybe more. What would happen to them? Who would take them once the waters receded? In what hole could they all be buried? Almost everyone he knew had left for a day or two, expecting little damage. He passed by their homes, so many of which he'd painted and even helped build, calculating how much was lost inside. It made him sick, the anguish this would cause. No one, he knew, had prepared for this adequately or at all. He thought of the animals, the squirrels, the mice, rats, frogs, possums, lizards, all gone. Millions of animals drowned. Only birds would survive this sort of apocalypse. Birds, some snakes, any beast that could find higher ground ahead of the rising tide. He looked for fish. If he was floating atop water shared with the lake, surely fish had been swept into the city. And on cue, he saw a murky form darting between submerged tree branches. He remembered the dogs. He rested his paddle on his lap, coasting, trying to place the pets he'd heard crying in the dark. He heard nothing. He was conflicted about what he was seeing, a refracted version of his city, one where homes and trees were bisected and mirrored in this oddly calm body of water. The novelty of the new world brought forth the adventurer in him. He wanted to see it all, the whole city, what had become of it. But the builder in him thought of the damage, how long it would take to rebuild. Years, maybe a decade. He wondered if the world at large could already see what he was seeing, a disaster mythical in scale and severity. In his neighborhood, miles from the closest levee, the water had risen slowly enough that he knew it was unlikely that anyone had died in the flood. But with a shudder, he thought of those closer to the breaches. He didn't know where the levees had failed, but he knew anyone living nearby would have been quickly overwhelmed. He turned on Vincennes Place and headed south. Someone called his name. He looked up to see a client of his, Frank Noland, a fit and robust man of about 60, leaning out from a second-story window. Zaytoun had done work on his house a few years ago. The Zaytouns would see Frank and his wife occasionally in the neighborhood, and they always exchanged warm greetings. Zaytoun waved and paddled over. "You got a cigarette?" Frank asked, looking down. Zaytoun shook his head no, and coasted closer to the window where Frank had appeared. It was a strange sensation, paddling over the man's yard. The usual barrier that would prevent one from guiding a vehicle up to the house was gone. He could glide directly from the street, diagonally across the lawn, and appear just a few feet below a second-story window. Zaytoun was just getting accustomed to the new physics of this world. Frank was shirtless, wearing only a pair of tennis shorts. His wife was behind him, and they had a guest in the house, another woman of similar age. Both women were dressed in t-shirts and shorts, suffering in the heat. It was early in the day, but the humidity was already oppressive. "You think you could take me to where I can buy some smokes?" Frank asked. Zaytoun told him that he didn't think any store would be open and selling cigarettes this day. Frank sighed. "See what happened to my motorcycle?" He pointed to the porch next door. Zaytoun remembered Frank talking about this motorcycle, an antique bike that he had bought, restored, and lavished attention on. Now it was under 6 feet of water.
As the water had risen the day before, Frank had moved it from the driveway up to the porch, and then to his next-door neighbor's porch, which was higher. But now it was gone. They could still see the faint, blurred likeness of the machine, like a relic from a previous civilization. He and Frank talked for a few minutes about the storm, the flood, how Frank had expected it, but then hadn't expected it at all. "Any chance you can take me to check on my truck?" Frank asked. Zaytoon agreed, but told Frank that he'd have to continue on a while longer. Zaytoon was planning to check on one of his rental properties, about 2 miles away. Frank agreed to come along for the ride, and climbed down from the window and into the canoe. Zaytoon gave him the extra paddle, and they were off. "Brand new truck," Frank said. He'd parked it on Fountain Blue, thinking that because the road was a foot or so higher than Vincennes, the truck would be spared. They made their way up 6 blocks to where Frank had parked the truck, and then Zaytoon heard Frank's quick intake of breath. The truck was under 5 feet of water and had migrated half a block. Like his motorcycle, it was gone, a thing of the past. "You want to get anything out of it?" Zaytoon asked. Frank shook his head. "I don't want to look at it. Let's go." They continued on. Soon they saw an older man, a doctor Zaytoon knew, on the second-floor porch of a white house. They paddled into the yard and asked the doctor if he needed help. "No, I've got somebody coming," he said. He had his housekeeper with him, he said, and they were well set up for the time being. A few doors down, Zaytoon and Frank came upon a house with a large white cloth billowing from the second-floor window. When they got closer, they saw a couple, a husband and wife in their 70s, leaning out of the window.
"You surrender?"
Frank asked. The man smiled. "You want to get out?" Zaytoon asked. "Yes, we do," the man said. They couldn't safely fit anyone else in the canoe, so Zaytoon and Frank promised to send someone back to the house as soon as they got to Claiborne. They assumed there would be activity there, that if anywhere would have a police or military presence, it would be Claiborne, the main thoroughfare nearby.
"We'll be right back," Zaytoon said.
As they were paddling away from the couple's house, they heard a faint female voice. It was a kind of moan, weak and tremulous.
"You hear that?" Zaytoon asked.
Frank nodded. "It's coming from that direction." They paddled toward the sound and heard the voice again.
"Help."
It was coming from a one-story house on Nashville. They coasted toward the front door and heard the voice again.
"Help me."
Zaytoon dropped his paddle and jumped into the water. He held his breath and swam to the porch. The steps came quicker than he thought. He jammed his knee against the masonry and let out a gasp. When he stood, the water was up to his neck.
"You okay?" Frank asked.
Zaytoon nodded and made his way up the steps.
"Hello?"
the voice said, now hopeful. He tried the front door. It was stuck. Zaytoon kicked the door. It wouldn't move. He kicked again. No movement. With the water now to his chest, he ran his body against the door. He did it again and again. Finally, it gave. Inside, he found a woman hovering above him. She was in her 70s, a large woman, over 200 pounds. Her patterned dress was spread out on the surface of the water like a great floating flower. Her legs dangled below. She was holding on to a bookshelf.
"Help me," she said.
Zaytoon talked gently to the woman,
assuring her that she would be taken care of. He knew that in all likelihood she'd been there, clinging to her furniture, for 24 hours or more. An elderly woman like this would have no chance of swimming to safety, much less have the strength to cut a hole through her roof. At least the water was warm. She might not have survived. Zaytoun pulled her out the front door and caught a glimpse of Frank in the canoe. His jaw had gone slack, his eyes disbelieving. No one knew what to do next. It would be very difficult to fit a woman of her size into the canoe under normal circumstances, and lifting her into it would require more than 2 men. Even if they could lift her and fit her inside, they couldn't possibly fit all 3 of them. The canoe would certainly capsize. He and Frank had a quick, whispered conversation. They had no choice but to leave her and find help. They would paddle quickly to Claiborne and flag down a boat. They told the woman the plan. She was unhappy to be left alone again, but there was no choice. They reached Claiborne in a few minutes and immediately saw what they were looking for, a fan boat. Zaytoun had never seen one in person, but they were familiar from movies. This was a military model, loud, with a great fan anchored perpendicularly to the rear. It was headed directly toward them. Zaytoun thought it was very lucky to have found another craft so quickly, and he was filled with something like pride, knowing that he had promised help and could now deliver it. He and Frank positioned their canoe in the path of the boat and waved their arms. The fanboat came straight for them, and when it was close, Zaytoun could see that there were 4 or 5 uniformed officers aboard. He wasn't sure if they were police or military, but he was very happy to see them. He waved, and Frank waved, both of them yelling, "Stop!" and "Help!" But the fanboat didn't stop. It swung around the canoe, holding Zaytoun and Frank, not even slowing down, and continued down Claiborne. The men aboard the fanboat barely glanced at them. The fanboat's wake nearly tipped their canoe. Zaytoun and Frank sat still, gripping either side until the waves subsided. They hardly had time to exchange incredulous looks when another boat came their way. Again it was a fanboat, also with 4 military personnel aboard, and again Zaytoun and Frank waved and called for help. Again the fanboat swung around them and continued without a word. This happened repeatedly over the next 20 minutes. 10 of these vessels, all staffed by soldiers or police officers, ignored their canoe and their calls for assistance. Where were these boats going? What were they looking for, if not for residents of the city asking for help? It defied belief. Finally, a different sort of boat approached. It was a small fishing boat manned by 2 young men. Though Zaytoun and Frank were disheartened and unsure if anyone would stop, they gave it a try. They stood in the canoe, they waved, they yelled. This boat stopped. "We need help," Frank said. "Okay, let's go," the men on the boat said. The young men threw a line to Zaytoun, who tied it to the canoe. The motorboat towed Zaytoun and Frank to the woman's house, and once they were close, the young men cut the engine and coasted toward the porch. Zaytoun jumped into the water again and swam to her door. The woman was exactly as they'd left her, in her foyer, floating near the ceiling. Now they only had to figure out how to get her into the fishing boat. She couldn't lift herself into the boat. That wasn't an option. She couldn't drop down into the water for leverage. It was too deep, and she couldn't swim. "You have a ladder, ma'am?" one of the young men asked. She did. She directed them to the detached garage at the end of the driveway. Zaytoun dropped into the water, swam to the garage, and retrieved it. When he brought it back, he set it on the ground and against the boat. The plan was that the woman would let go of the bookshelf, grab the ladder, put her feet onto it,
and climb up until she was above the boat and able to step into the hull. Zaytun held the ladder while the two young men steadied it against the boat, ready to receive her. It seemed an ingenious plan. But she couldn't climb the ladder. She had a bad leg, she said, and couldn't put pressure on it. It took a certain degree of agility, and she was 80 years old, weakened by staying awake for 24 hours while floating near her ceiling, thinking only that she might drown in her own home. "I'm sorry," she said. There was only one option now, they decided. They'd use the ladder as a sort of gurney. They'd prop one end on the side of the fishing boat, and one of the young men would stand on the porch, holding the other side. They'd then have to lift it high enough to get her over the lip of the boat and far enough in that she could roll into the hull. Zaytun realized that two men, one on either end of the ladder, would not be enough to lift a woman over 200 pounds. He knew he'd have to push from below. So when the two young men were in position and the woman was ready, Zaytun took a deep breath and went under. From below the surface, he could see the woman let go of the bookshelf and grab the ladder. It was awkward, but she managed to place herself atop it, as if it were a kind of raft. As she put weight on the ladder, Zaytun positioned his shoulders under it and pushed up. The motion was akin to a shoulder press machine he'd once used at a gym. He straightened his legs, and as he did, the ladder rose from the water until he saw light breaking the surface, until he felt the air on his face and was finally able to exhale. The woman rolled into the bed of the boat. It wasn't a graceful landing, but she managed to sit up. Though she was wet and breathing heavily, she was unhurt. Zaytun shuddered as he watched her recover. It wasn't right to watch a woman of her age suffer like this. The situation had stolen her dignity, and it pained him to bear witness. Zaytun climbed back into the canoe. Frank, smiling and shaking his head, stretched out his hand from the fishing boat. "That was something," Frank said. Zaytun shook his hand and smiled. The men sat in silence, letting the woman determine when it was time to go. They knew it was an impossible thing for her to see her house like this, untold damage and loss within. At her age, and with the years it would take to restore the home, she would likely never return. They gave her a moment. Finally, she nodded, and they arranged their convoy. Zaytun was alone in the canoe, being towed behind. He was soaked and exhausted. With Frank directing the fishing boat, they made their way toward the couple who'd been waving the white cloth. On the way there, they heard another cry for help. It was another older couple in their 70s, waving from their second-story window. "You ready to leave?" Frank asked. "We are," the man in the window said. The young fisherman brought the caravan to the window, and the couple, fit and agile, lowered themselves into it. With 6 people now aboard the fishing boat, they arrived at the White Flag house. The couple living there lowered themselves down, making the number in the fishing boat 8. The young men had seen a temporary medical staging ground set up at the intersection of Napoleon and St. Charles, and they agreed that they would deliver the passengers there. It was time for Zaytun and Frank to part ways with their companions. Frank stepped back into the canoe and said goodbye. "Good luck with everything," one of the young men said.
"You too," Zaytun said.
They had never exchanged names. In Baton Rouge, Kathy was again driving to kill time, her car full of children. Needing distraction from the news on the radio, it was getting worse every hour. She stopped periodically at whatever stores or restaurants were open. Zaytun had sounded so calm on the phone the previous night, before his phone had given out. But since then, conditions in the city had devolved. She was hearing reports of unchecked violence, widespread chaos, thousands presumed dead. What was her lunatic husband doing there? She tried his phone again and again, hoping he had somehow found a way to charge it. She tried the home phone, in case the water had miraculously dropped below the phone box and the wiring was undamaged. She got nothing. The lines were dead. On the radio, they were reporting that another 10,000 National Guardsmen were being sent to the region, about one-third of them directed to maintain order. There would soon be 21,000 National Guard troops in the area, coming from all over the country. West Virginia, Utah, New Mexico, Missouri. How could her husband be so calm when every branch of the armed forces was scrambling? She turned off the radio and tried Zaytoun again. Nothing. She knew she shouldn't worry yet, but her mind took dark turns. If she was out of touch with her husband already, how would she know if anything was wrong? How would she know if he was alive, in danger, dead? She was getting ahead of herself. He was in no danger. The winds were gone, and now it was just water, placid water. And troops were on their way. No cause for worry. Returning to her family's house in Baton Rouge, she found her mother there. She'd come to deliver ice. She greeted all the kids and looked at Kathy. "Why don't you take off that thing and relax?" she said, pointing to Kathy's hijab. "He's not here. Be yourself." Kathy suppressed a dozen things she wanted to say, and instead channeled her rage into packing. She'd take the kids and go to a motel, a shelter, anywhere, maybe to Arizona. It just wasn't working in Baton Rouge, and it was all so much worse not knowing where Zaytoun was. Why did that man insist on staying? It was a cruel thing, really. He wanted to make sure that his family was safe, but Kathy, his wife, wasn't afforded the same certainty. When they next spoke, she was determined to get him to leave the city. It didn't matter anymore why he wanted to stay. Forget the house and property. Nothing could be worth it. In New Orleans, Zaytoun was invigorated. He'd never felt such urgency and purpose. In his first day in his flooded city, he'd already assisted in the rescue of 5 elderly residents. There was a reason, he now knew, that he'd remained in the city. He'd felt compelled to stay by a power beyond his own reckoning. He was needed. Zaytoun and Frank's next stop was Zaytoun's property, back on Claiborne, at number 5010. He and Kathy had owned the home, a 2-story residence, for 5 years. It was a rental unit, with 4 to 6 tenants at any given time. When they arrived, they found Todd Gambino, one of Zaytoun's tenants, on the front porch, a bottle of beer in his hand. Todd was a stout man in his late 30s and had lived there as long as the Zaytouns had owned the building. He worked as a mechanic at a Speedy oil change and tune-up franchise most of the week and had a part-time job delivering lost luggage for the airport. He was a good tenant. They'd never had a late check or any sort of problem from him. He stood up, incredulous, as Zaytoun approached. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "Really, I came to check on the building," Zaytoun said, smiling, knowing how ludicrous it sounded. "I wanted to check on you." Todd couldn't believe it. Zaytoun and Frank got out of the canoe and tied it to the porch. They were both happy to stand on solid ground again. Todd offered them beers. Zaytoun passed. Frank accepted and sat on the porch steps while Zaytoun went inside. Todd lived in the first floor unit.